This is an encore edition of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Vicki returns live in June.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, today's the third Monday of the month, and we typically talk about business and career issues and explore how people have created their own unique work lifestyles for themselves. And both of my guests today fall into that category for sure. My second guest today is Chris Hanks. He's a lecturer at the University of Georgia. He's also a serial entrepreneur, and he started his first two businesses to put himself through college. He literally sold T-shirts and offered local florists a delivery service and put himself through college doing that. So if you've ever dreamed of going into business for yourself but don't think you're creative enough or you don't like to take risks, Chris Hanks is going to tell us today, or he's going to argue with us at least, that entrepreneurism is not about risk and it's not about creativity. So stay tuned to find out what it is about, in his opinion. First, we've all had dreams in life. Maybe you've dreamt about becoming a competitive ballroom dancer or a nurse. Maybe you wanted to be a mother or a keynote speaker, or maybe you want to be an international mountain climber. Well, my first guest has accomplished all of these amazing feats and more. Kayla Clair has not only overcome physical challenges, she's battled depression, heart arrhythmias, and all the day-to-day challenges of raising a family, as well as becoming the oldest woman to climb and peak the seven summits. In fact, she climbed over 50 mountains, and get this, she didn't start climbing until she was 51. So I'm really excited today to talk to Kay. Kayla Clair, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Vicki. I'm happy to be here talking with you.
Yes, and I want to know a lot more about you. I've read a lot about you, but it is fascinating to me when people just accomplish what a lot of people think are the impossible things in life. And I know from reading your background, you consider yourself an ordinary woman, but you've done some extraordinary things, risen to some extraordinary challenges. So I guess I want to just go back and look at how you grew up. And I understand you grew up in a small town in Iowa. Your father had a job with the USAID program, but you did get to travel with that. He went to Panama and Europe, right?
Yes. And actually, there was one little mistake in the article. I was born and spent part of my childhood in Idaho, way out in the northwest,
right?
Not Iowa.
Oh, okay. Big difference.
Yes. So, yes, there are actually mountains out here in the northwest. So I think that gave me some incentive for my late life hobby.
Yeah, and I would think it gave you, set off some kind of sense of adventure in you.
Well, I attribute that to my parents. They love the outdoors. And in fact, my father was an extension agent, a county agent in Idaho, and it was a wonderful childhood because we would go to the county fair every year. He would judge sheep, horses, and cattle, and so I was used to living in a rural area on a farm, and then used to help with the haying every summer when I got old enough. And so, and we used to go fishing and hiking and camping. So I think I developed a love of the outdoors at my very early age.
Yeah, and certainly a good work ethic too, because that's not easy work, the work that you were doing as a young child.
Exactly. And my parents were both from farm families and very hard workers, and we knew when it was time to harvest the crops, you put in long hours, and it's very similar to climbing in a way, because you wait, of course you're getting your fields ready and everything, that's work, but then when the actual harvest comes in, everybody pitches in, and it's teamwork and a lot of long hours.
Yeah, lot of preparation, as you said. I had to laugh at this because I this was the same article, so you know maybe this was wrong too. I don't know, but you'll tell us if it was. But I read in this article, and I thought this has to be the ultimate in family planning. That when your sister and I were born, your parents had you placed almost 6 years apart because they wanted to make sure that both of you got to college, and they figured that when one of you had finished, they could help pay for the second one. Then
that was the way they planned it. They both came from very, very poor families. And my mother grew up in East Texas, a family of, she had eight brothers and sisters. And after 2 years of crop failure, their parents lost the cotton, you know, their cotton farm. And at that time in their lives, mom's now 94, the children had to be parsed out to as laborers for other families. So it was, you know, they were difficult times and, you know, tough, but
right.
They made a lot, you know, made a go of their lives. And
right.
We're used to saving money. And in fact, I got myself into trouble because mom and dad used to keep a jar on the table where they would save all their pennies, and were saving up to buy a new mattress for me. And I was quite young then. I managed to crawl on the table, swallow two or three pennies, and then unfortunately out of a hospital bill instead of a new mattress.
Oh. See, even the best laid plans sometimes go awry. That's a good lesson.
Yes.
There. Let's shoot forward a little bit. It sounds as though you had a happy childhood and a lot of great parenting from your parents. I love how you met your husband. You said, my insects were on his flowers. Tell us how you guys met.
Oh, well, yes, that was an interesting story. We had both just finished college. My husband went to Harvard and had a degree in biology, and I graduated from Arizona State University and had a degree in nursing. But I was also connected with the entomology lab and had been collecting insects for years. So there were separate schools, we were doing a grant with the National Science Foundation, and we were doing a comparison of two desert ecosystems, one in Arizona and a similar one in Argentina, northwest Argentina. And so I arrived with my group from Arizona State, and Jerry had already been down there for about 9 months. We collaborated with our research projects because he was doing the botanical research, and then of course I was collecting insects. So it turned into a perfect relationship.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
And you guys married in 1974.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Moved back.
Came back to the States and got married.
And you stayed for a while in New York State, where your husband was teaching.
Yes, we were both looking for jobs then, and unfortunately, with a degree in biology, it doesn't offer as many opportunities for work. So he was able to get a job teaching at a private school in Poughkeepsie, New York. He was their science teacher there, and luckily, with my bachelor's in nursing, I was easily able to get a position at the hospital there.
Right. Now you have a son. When I think this is another testament to your perseverance and your curiosity. When your son was 6 months old, you took some time off. You decided you were too housebound, though, so you went to school. But you didn't just go to take flower arranging. You actually went to law school and got your law degree.
Yes, I did. That was at Gonzaga University in Spokane. We had moved back to the Northwest, partially to be close to my family, and you know, my husband really enjoyed the area, so it was an easy move for us. But yes, I was used to working and decided to try law school. It was that or business school, you know, just to keep my mind active.
Mm-hmm.
And I of course still had some time for my little son, although he was in daycare for a while. And then after I graduated from law school, that's when I took a look at myself and my little son, who had been in daycare all this time, and realized that it was time to become a full-time mom. And that was one of the most wonderful things I ever did, was raising him.
Yeah, so many people say that. But at some point, he said, he was starting to grow up, and he said, you know, Mom, go get a life. So what did you do?
You can understand he was 15 years old, and he really did not need mother hovering around him anymore. You know, he was becoming independent, had his own friends in school, and I took that to heart. I said, you know, I thought about it. I said, oh, yes, I devoted a lot of time to being a full-time mom, kept up the house and the yard, and so I decided, well, maybe I'll try taking some dance lessons and just doing that for myself, and really enjoyed it. And it seems like whatever I do, I put my all into it. So it became competitive for a while. And we usually travel in the Northwest somewhere for ballroom competitions. And it was a lot of fun and great exercise as well.
Yeah, it was. So we're going to take a quick break in just a moment, Kay. And I want to talk about... you've kind of brought us up to, I don't know what age you were there, but you didn't start climbing until you were 51. So I want to see, that's a time when most people would say, I'm too old to start climbing now. And yet you went on to climb more than 50 mountains after the age of 51. So I want to talk about that when we come back.
All right.
And my guest today is Kayla Clare, and as you can tell, she's a pretty amazing woman. She is a mountaineer and athlete and speaker and so much more. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Come on, come on, let's work together. Now, people,
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
For the people, by the people. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And boy, we're speaking with a live one today. Kayla Clair has accomplished many, many achievements in her life. Just last week, I said that she's climbed over 50 mountains in 10 years. Just 10 years. She didn't start climbing until she was 51, but there's much more to her than that, I know. You just got back last week, Kay. You just climbed Mount Rainier. And you were saying you didn't really have any recovery time when you got back. So, and you was, you don't mind, I'll share your age, 61, I think, right now, because I read that in a couple of different articles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm 62 now, and this was a special climb. It was my second attempt in just a little over a week, climbing Mount Rainier in Washington State, and it was just, I must say, we did not have the best weather days. We were attempting a little more difficult route, the Couch, and then our group had to turn around and go down because of high winds. So I went back a day later and decided to go ahead and try to solo climb the Disappointment Cleaver route.
Mm.
And so I was lucky enough to be issued a solo climbing permit by the park because of my experience. But I felt it important to, I managed to find a rope team who was going up and asked if I could rope in with them just for safety reasons. So, and the park rangers love that. They always love to see that you're going to be a responsible person when you climb.
Yeah.
And once again, not stellar weather. It was very, very windy and was snowing. And so we were very close to the summit when we decided to turn around because one of our little climbers was developing some altitude sickness and became very dizzy. So it's always wise to, you know, just you can climb another day.
Yes.
So we went down.
Yeah. And tell me what went into thinking about the thinking behind climbing your first mountain, because, you know, as I said, most people at 51 wouldn't think they were going to start mountain climbing. So go ahead.
I had an idea in mind. You know, when my son was only 6 months old, my husband had bought a book for me called The Challenge of Rainier, which I read cover to cover. And I had always wanted to climb Mount Rainier, but I put the book away. I didn't have the time. And it wasn't until I saw an article in Seattle Magazine in 2000, and one of the fun things you could do during the summer was climb Rainier. So that piqued my enthusiasm again. I talked my son into climbing with me. And so that's how I got started climbing. It was kind of in the back of my mind, but didn't have the opportunity until age 51.
Mm. And then the following year, as I understand it, your son and husband took a family trip to Africa, and that's where you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. Again, no easy feat.
Yes, we did. After our 2.5-month course in mountain school here in Spokane, we thought it would be fun to take a family vacation and all try to climb Kilimanjaro together. And that worked out beautifully. And then that Kilimanjaro turned out to be the first of my seven summits.
And what made you decide to go for the seven summits?
Well, that was due to a friend of mine in the Spokane Mountaineers who I came back and I was just elated about our climbing trip. And he said, well, have you ever thought of climbing the seven summits? Well, I didn't know much about it. So I read up, and because I was retired at the time, I had a little extra time to go climbing. So then I signed up with a guide service in Seattle and headed off to Russia to climb the highest peak in Europe.
And so this became obviously a goal for you then, this climbing the seven summits. But, you know, I know from talking with many mountaineers just how expensive this is. How did you go about funding your climbs? I know that money is not something that drives you. You say you've always been lucky to pursue your interests. So how do you actually fund your trips to do these seven summits?
Well, thankfully, my family was very supportive. I didn't get sponsors per se, but my family helped put the bills, and I'm sure they were especially getting tired of my four attempts on Everest, which is not an inexpensive trip. And you know, my husband and I agreed in 2009. I was over 60. And that was to be my last attempt on Everest, which made sense. Not only was I getting up in years to do something that strenuous, but it's a huge financial drain as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the first attempt on Everest, I believe, is when you you started having heart arrhythmias. A lot of people do get sick at that altitude, don't they? As they're even at base camp altitude.
Yes, that's true. I mean, high altitude can bring on all kinds of complications. The ones we worry about most are pulmonary edema and cerebral edema, but certainly your heart's ticking away quite rapidly. And what we didn't realize, since I'd had a full medical exam before I left, was that my heart was reacting to the drug and an inhaler that I was using to try to prevent a cough. Which is very common too, a high altitude cough, because you're breathing such, you know, thin air and it's cold and dry. So I had to be helicoptered off and down to Kathmandu, and then sent back to the States. So the doctors realized what had happened, and I had to undergo a procedure called an ablation to try to prevent my heart from misfiring. Mm-hmm. And luckily it worked beautifully, so I was okay to go back to Everest again.
Yeah. So then, on your fourth attempt, you do summit, and this made me laugh because this is your fourth attempt, and you do summit. You come back down to base camp, and some of the teammates, you say, were injured. They needed to be helicoptered off the mountain. You called your husband and said, "You know, I'd really like to get out of here," and he said, "Kay, you can walk."
That's right. And he was absolutely right, too. It's just after almost 9 weeks and finally accomplishing my goal, I was really homesick and I was ready to go home. But it was only a few more days. And, so he was absolutely right on that point. I mean, I was perfectly capable of walking out, whereas others desperately needed the helicopter. They'd suffered injuries and had pneumonia, and so really needed that helicopter back to Kathmandu.
Right, right. You talk about fear and overcoming fear, and you say that all climbers go through that fear. And there's one example that I read where I think it was in mountaineers training, and you were climbing the mini Haha rocks, and you were hanging and couldn't find a root or a handhold or a foothold. And so you're just hanging there, and you're so afraid that you started whimpering. How did you keep going after that? How did you just not think, okay, this isn't for me?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I was absolutely terrified. And, you know, I was on a rope. I was being top roped, so there was no danger of me falling. But there's something about clinging to bare rock. You really, you know, your whole system says, don't fall, don't fall, don't fall. And, of course, some climbers do. And I wasn't at risk, but I was terrified. I was shaking, and I couldn't see the next handhold. And, unfortunately, I'm very short. So when an instructor will say, well, reach right up there, well, you know, I can't reach up that far. So my instructor very bluntly said, you know, when I asked him, what should I do? He said, go up. And it made me so angry that I did.
You thought, I'll show him, huh?
Yes, well, it's, and you do, you know, I think every climber must admit you do reach a point in your, you know, your climbing where you realize you're in a very dangerous, precarious situation, and you just have to get a grip and, you know, try to focus and overcome your fear, and it can be very, very difficult.
Yeah, talk about putting a mental block on everything negative and focusing on getting up.
Exactly.
I imagine that, you know, long monkey arms would really come in handy when you're climbing. It just, you said you're short. How short are you? How tall are you?
I'm shrinking as I get older, but I'm now 5'1".
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so a reach for you is kind of limited as opposed to somebody for 6 foot, yeah.
Yes, I know. My climbing partner's about 6 foot and has very long legs.
Uh-huh.
But that's all right. I get the job done anyway.
I want to talk about a couple of your adventures here, other than that one. I mean, I know you've had lots and lots over the years, but there's one you talk about on your first summit attempt on Denali in 2003. And you and your teammates made it to high camp before a terrific storm blew in. 100-mile-per-hour winds, disintegrating tents were flying up into the air. How do you get through something like that?
It is, I think, you know, I can remember just lying in a tent and hearing the winds howling and, you know, the tent starts to flatten out against your face. And I'm thinking, oh, I really hope these winds die down pretty soon or something awful is going to happen. And sure enough, that's when I could, above the howling wind, I could hear the guide's voice saying, everybody, you have to get up. You have to pack your gear. You have to get out right now that your tent is just going to disintegrate. And so I was like, and a little robot. I just shoved everything in my pack and started to crawl through the blinding snow. And so fortunate, I found another tent to crawl into. And so at very cramped quarters, there were two other fellows in there. And we spent a miserable night, but we survived the storm. Mm. So I don't think it really, you know, it doesn't really hit you until later on, and you just go, phew.
Right.
I made it.
I would imagine you're just too busy trying to cope and deal with the situation.
Right.
You exactly. have to be very much present in the moment, don't you? You can't be writing next week's shopping list or anything like that while that's going on. Was there ever a time, Kay, during your climbs when you thought, that's it, I'm never climbing again?
Oh, yes. On my three other attempts on Everest, it is such a huge time commitment. It is I came back 1 year. I'd lost 12 pounds, which I couldn't afford to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend started weeping when I got off the plane. She took one look at me, and I guess I looked like a survivor from Auschwitz. But I thought then, you know, it's like, okay, this is it. I can't take this anymore. About typical of most of us who've been through this, about 2 weeks later, we start going, okay, gosh, I really love climbing. It was hard work, but here we go. We sign up again.
Right. You kind of, I guess it's like childbirth. You forget the pain and just focus on the end result.
Exactly. That's a good one, yes. Yeah. And finally my husband got used to this. I mean, I would say, okay, that's it. I'm selling my climbing gear. And he goes, right. He says, I'll give you 2 weeks. And sure enough, back again.
Mm. You say that one of the things that bothers you about climbing is that's the attitude that some climbers have that runs counter to your way of thinking. You definitely don't call attention to your accomplishments, and yet they're amazing. How so?
You mean?
You're not at all arrogant about this, and yet this is. I mean, it's really significant to climb some of these peaks that you've done.
No, I'm a firm believer in the mountain. Kind of dictates. It's when climbers say, "Oh yes, I went out and I conquered Mount Everest."
It allowed you to.
I have a whole different attitude on that one. I am very humbled by these incredible mountains, mm-hmm. and the weather plays a huge factor. And I'm just so grateful when I can go out and climb. And of course, there are many times I have not made the summit, but it's still a sense of accomplishment. And I never look at my other attempts on Everest as failures. They're always a learning experience.
Right.
And part of the goal, I think, why I enjoy climbing so much is not only the great physical endurance, but the wonderful friends and just the teamwork. And to heck with conquering mountains. It's just an exhilarating experience with lots of good friends.
Mm-hmm. I read that you say it saddens you to think that some people's only goal in life is making money. What motivates you? What inspires you?
That's kind of a tough one. Certainly, I mean, everyone loves having money, but I think, for me, it's just I so much enjoy trying new things and living life, and life has been such a wonderful journey for me, and that's what I look forward to every day. Luckily I'm not struggling monetarily as some folks are, so of course that makes it easier for me. But it's not like I still don't have to watch my nickels and dimes.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, one of my huge goals that I love dearly is being able to do fundraisers for organizations, for people who are much less fortunate and have just extreme handicaps in life. And we just, our climb on Rainier was to benefit SADS, the sudden arrhythmia death syndrome, or long QT syndrome, where, people of all ages just suddenly die of a heart condition that
right.
they do nothing about.
Right.
And so that's part of my goal right now is fundraising, which I really enjoy.
Well, that's great. What do you tell people about goal setting, Kay? Because you've had to, as you talked earlier and showed, a lot of planning, a lot of preparation. So what do you tell people about goal setting?
Well, I think the first thing I tell them is, like with my goals, I started small. you go out hiking with climbing, for instance, and then you find that you build up your endurance, and then you're able to climb Mount Rainier, and then it takes a lot of work, I do set goals, and I talk to other people about planning trips like this. That's true of, I think, all of our goals in life. You start out with baby steps, and then you can take larger steps later on broaden your horizons.
Right.
But my biggest point is, please don't be afraid to try something new. If you've got an idea of something you would love to do or like to try, give it a go. It could change your whole life.
Absolutely, absolutely. I read that you suffered with depression at one point, something that, many people do. I would guess that you're not somebody who just gave in to that. How did you deal with it?
Oh, yes. I had a very difficult time, not only as a teenager in college, and then when I first, first got married, too. I suffered from, it was basically chronic depression. And so spent time in therapy and then on different medications. And, you know, I was busy working full-time as a nurse then. And, you know, of course, we were trying to get ahead. We did not have that much money. And so it was, you know, a lot of people go through this. It's very stressful and difficult. And, of course, the more you're worried about something, the more difficult it becomes. But for me, I discovered it wasn't the drugs that helped. It was making friends.
Mm-hmm.
And as my son said, you know, getting a life. And then I started exercising. And for me, it was the power of exercise. It really turned my life around. First with the, you know, I took aerobics classes and I started to feel good about myself. I lost weight. You know, suddenly I had some muscle. And I had friends who, you know, if I had problems at home, I could discuss problems with friends instead of sitting in a therapist's office.
Right, right.
So that, I would highly recommend for anyone, just, you know, if you have the time and or make the time to get out and get outdoors and, you know, go for a hike, walk around the block, get a pet. I mean, my dog and I have been companions. We go on runs together. But people need companionship, and they need the exercise to relieve the daily stress of work and other things that are going on.
Yeah, good advice. So you completed the seven summits. You were the oldest woman to complete those seven summits. I read that you booked up for the Coeur d'Alene, and I know
yes.
You had an injury and you were delayed a little on that, but where are you at with the Coeur d'Alene?
Okay, well, yes, last year I was 5 weeks from the Coeur d'Alene Ironman competition, and for those who don't know, it's a real test of endurance. It's a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and a marathon, 26.2 miles. So I started training 5 weeks from the event last year. I fractured my collarbone and now sport a plate with seven screws, but luckily have full mobility. So I signed up this year and started the race, and things were going beautifully until my second loop around the swim course, and I developed hypothermia. So I had to be pulled from the water. So my everything was cut short, but I signed up for next year.
There you go. I was going to say, I'm sure you don't see that as failure. It's just one step closer to finishing next year.
And well, you know, and those type of things happen all the time. They certainly have with climbing, and I'll know better what to expect next year, and hopefully our water temperature will warm up. It was quite cold because of our huge snowpack and the
right.
You know, runoff into the lake.
Right. Well, Kay, I thank you for being with us. I know that the oldest lady who finished the Coeur d'Alene race was 78. She was a Roman Catholic nun named Sister
yes.
Madonna Buddha. So you've got some competition there.
Oh, Sister Madonna is my idol. I mean, she is just a wonderful woman and has now come out with a book, and I hope to do the same shortly. I'm in the process of finishing a little children's book.
Well,
when
you have that ready, please let me know. We'll have you back on the show. It's been fascinating
you.
Talking to you, and you're such an inspiration. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Kay?
Just go out there and live life, you know, just remember you're going to have a lot of setbacks. We all do, but forge ahead, and you know, you can do it. Just tell yourself that. You can do it.
Thank you so much for being with us, Kay. Thank you.
And thank you, Christy.
Listeners can find out more about Kay at kayleclaire.com, kayleclaire.com. There's a lot of information up there about her and her mountain climbing, and just finished the seven summits and is working on the Coeur d'Alene. So at the age of 62 now. So, yeah, no excuses, anybody. Please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with entrepreneur and educator Chris Hanks, and he's going to shed some light on why creativity and risk isn't necessarily involved in entrepreneurship. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. 4772.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair June 4th at 12 noon Pacific. How would you feel if you found out the government has taken away your right to full disclosure on what you eat and where it comes from? That's reality in Iowa, and several other states may soon follow. Join Vicky on June 4th as she welcomes one of the country's foremost experts on the meat packing and processing industry for an inside look at how large corporations have achieved such power and what can be done about it. Don't miss a single episode of Conversations Live every Monday at noon Pacific, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And as I said at the top of the hour, we're talking with somebody else who has built his own unique work lifestyle. And his name is Chris Hanks. He's an entrepreneur and lecturer at the University of Georgia. He teaches entrepreneurship at the Terry College of Business. He's also a co-author of School for Startups, along with Jim Beach, who I believe he does a lot of business with, partnering with. And I'm going to bring Chris on and let him share his own journey with us right now. Chris Hanks, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
Well, this was interesting. A couple of things in here that really differentiate you from a lot of business books and startup, you know, how to start your own business kind of thing. But I wanted to look, first of all, a little bit more about your background. I told our listeners at the top of the hour that you first started your first two businesses while you were at college.
Yeah, sure did.
Tell us about that.
Let's see. Well, you know, and actually that was more like entrepreneurship sort of as a survival tool more than anything else. You know, I started selling T-shirts to sort of get by, and then I couldn't find a job, so I started a delivery service with a whole bunch of local businesses who couldn't pay a delivery person like minimum wage, so I just went and got clients and just got flat fees and delivered it all over town. So, and actually did better with that than I would have any other job, and actually ended up selling that business when I graduated. So.
Wow. And so you leave college, you go to work in the corporate world as a risk management consultant?
I did, yeah. And, you know, and I was always really blessed with good jobs, and I couldn't really understand why, like, Saturday about 3 o'clock, I'd start getting grumpy because the next day was Sunday and the next day was Monday. You know, from Friday at 5 to Saturday at 3, I was really good. And you know, I had good jobs too. And so I didn't really understand why. What was it about me? Why wasn't I just thrilled to death about getting out of bed in the morning?
And so did you figure that out?
Yeah. Well, you know, fortunately I did. I didn't realize I had this entrepreneurial bug. I just knew I did not like, you know, working for somebody else. I didn't like the structure of corporate life and all that. Again, I've had a good corporate background, so it wasn't anything like negative experiences. It's just like, wow, I knew there was something wrong with me. So I remember going to taking an extended lunch and buying an entrepreneur magazine and flipping to the back and seeing, a franchise for sale. I thought, well, shoot, I could maybe do this. And then that kind of started my journey.
And that lit your fire, as they say.
Yeah.
So I understand you bought a CD store when you left that.
Yeah.
And tell us what other businesses you've had since then.
Let's see, I did the CD store, then I bought an entertainment business and a recording studio and got in the music business really heavily, and then the dot-com boom happened, and then I got involved in the 3 dot-coms. I sold to a public company in Canada, and so did the dot-com thing, and then I started buying and selling businesses almost like people do with real estate, you know? Like, I'd see a business for sale that I thought was undervalued, and then I'd buy it with the intention of running it for a while and possibly flipping it. And then I realized I was making a lot of mistakes, and so I became a certified business appraiser. And now I do a lot of testimony on how much businesses are worth and sit on the stand to do that. So I started buying and selling businesses. So I've owned so many businesses, but they're smaller businesses. So they're not anything large or household name. But got involved in a variety of things, from exporting heavy-duty tractor trailers to Vietnam, to a publishing business that publishes data for the angel investment and venture capital community in the Southeast.
Wow, really diverse, really diverse.
Yeah, very much so.
So it's not a case of you have to do what you know, I guess, do what interests you. Was that what was driving you?
Well, I thought that was the case when I first started launching. Like, that's why I got into music. I thought, you know, to be an entrepreneur, you really have to be passionate about what, you know, the thing that your business does. And so that's what I thought. And so I got involved in music. I thought, well, I really like music, so that'll be great. But I didn't realize until later on that, you know, in entrepreneurship, you don't make much money being the doer of the thing that you do. You know, you got to be the owner of the thing that you do. And so then that changed my viewpoint. And so the analogy sort of I give in class that seems to resonate with some students is, you know, so, you know, like, the think about your definition of success. And so, like, let's say that we're going to go to Disney World. And that's how we define success, is getting to Disney World. What vehicle we drive to take us to Disney World doesn't really matter as long as it hits certain criteria. You know, it's got to be air conditioning, got to have four doors, got to have a DVD player, XM radio. But, you know, we can find lots of vehicles that take us to that. But the point is that if one of those vehicles doesn't work or breaks down or gets less fun, we can just change vehicles. But the point is, we're going to Disney World.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I started getting more into, like, look, you know, the business is a vehicle to get me there. I started looking at the business model as opposed to the business itself. So there's a lot of things about the businesses that I've owned. Like, I'm not a home improvement guy at all. I'm the worst home improvement guy in the world. You know, I can't fix anything. But yet I owned a painting business for years. But I love the business model of painting.
Right.
I mean, name another business where if you show up on time and sober, you've exceeded customer expectations. So I love that about the business of painting. But talking about painting bored me. But
right.
The business of painting, I'm thrilled by. So, you know, it becomes you look at it through a different lens if you're the owner of the thing that you do.
Right. Interesting. And the main goal of the book that you've written with Jim Beach and with David Beasley is called School for Startups, is to show how to start a business without risking your home, your savings, your retirement plan. You talk about bootstrapping. Tell us what you mean by that.
Bootstrapping is essentially a way of starting a business without regard to resources whatsoever. An example probably would suit best. Like, I make all of my students in class bootstrap a business. They have half a semester to be profitable in a business, And the rule is you're not allowed to spend any of your own money or anybody else's money. So a bootstrapping example would be, okay, I'm going to start a website. And instead of waiting for money or asking for people for money to develop the website, you go out and get five sponsors for that website or advertisers who prepay you now. So, and you get that money, and then you use that money to start the website. So you're creating so much value that the customers say, wow, yeah, I want to be one of your only five sponsors for this website. So absolutely, I'll give you the money today if you can secure one of my spots as a sponsor.
Oh,
and so you're pre-selling, you're doing a whole bunch of creative things. So that way you make a business profitable, mm-hmm. and you don't have to wait for a bank or an angel investor or a rich family member to give you money.
Mm, interesting. And a couple of myths that I want to bust straight up, because we don't have a lot of time today, and I do want to make sure I get this out. You say you don't have to be creative. You don't have to be a risk taker to start successful business.
That's correct.
So I wonder if you'd talk on those two things, please.
Well, the creativity piece, like a lot of people wait are just like waiting for this magical event to happen where they're just struck by this bolt of lightning of creativity and they've got this idea that's never been done before. And that's just a, that'll probably never happen. And you don't have to be creative. You can Google what are the 50 best businesses to start, and you will find tons of businesses. You can Google the best franchises to start, because there's a franchise in just about every industry, and not necessarily you have to buy that franchise, but it'll give you a list of, wow, I didn't realize that medical records was really a hot area. You know, how can I get into that? How could I bootstrap that? So creativity is not a necessity. In fact, Babson College did a study where over 93% of existing businesses are replications of already existing ideas. So the idea that, you know, I have to do something completely original, you don't. You could start a landscaping business. That's been done before. But yours can be unique, and you can service your target market in a unique way that's not currently being served. So the idea of waiting for something that's completely innovative and disruptive is sort of an unrealistic viewpoint. Mm. There's so many ways we can design a system to make enough money for you and your family, and you do something that you truly enjoy without waiting for this creativity lightning.
And you don't have to be a risk taker, because this is the thing that I know a lot of people. In fact, I was watching video of you and your partner, Jim Beach, on at least partnering on this book. And Jim said that his first marriage broke up because his wife couldn't handle not having a paycheck every Friday afternoon.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And he said that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I see that as an element that affects a lot of people.
Yeah, it really does. And that's one of the biggest things that keep people away from entrepreneurship. And one of the reasons that the book really emphasizes that point, and when both of us speak in front of groups, we really, really address a lot of the risk issues. You know, because and this is not an exaggeration, but I am an entrepreneur because I am risk averse. I mean, I really don't like taking risks. And so the idea that you have to be a maverick or a gambler or somebody who runs with scissors to be an entrepreneur just is not true. Like, what if we didn't launch our business until we had a marketing system that guaranteed a certain level of revenue each month? And we worked really super hard until we had that done. You know, like that. So that would take care of somebody's income concern.
Right, right.
And they say, well, gosh, you know, somebody could still, like, you know, like what we'll do is, like, the process of this low-risk entrepreneurship is, you know, we can approach it from several different ways. One of them is we could just start a business on the side while you're continuing to work. Like, for example, we could start a drop shipping business where essentially we throw up a website, we get a product, like a manufacturer of a product. Say you enjoy sunglasses. We could get that sunglasses. You have a website. People order sunglasses from you. You keep most of the money, or you keep part of the money, and then you when you get an order from a customer, and then you you send the order to the drop shipper, the person who actually physically ships the product to the customer.
Yeah. Yeah. Chris, we're almost at the end of our time. I'm so sorry, but there's so much information in this book that I would just love to get out to our listeners. Maybe we'll have to have you back.
Oh, yeah, no. But
there's a lot of really great information in here, and I want listeners to be able to find you. Quickly, please give me a website here.
Sure. It's it's the Terry, Terry.uga.edu is where I can be found.
Okay, thank you so much, Chris,
for
being with
so
us
much.
Today. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
And we have to run. Thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.